tonight on Arena. We review An Octoroon, which opened at the Abbey Theatre earlier this week. And 10 years on, we look at the phenomenon that was Lena Dunham's Girls. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. A play written by an Irish playwright over 160 years ago, a melodrama about slaves and their slave owners in America's Deep South, is creating quite a buzz at the Abbey Theatre. The play is An Octoroon, written by Dion Boucicault in 1859 as The Octoroon. But the reason for the buzz is that it was adapted in 2014 by an American playwright, Brandon Jacobs Jenkins, who recreated the play, turning the racial stereotypes in the original on their head. The play stars Patrick Martins as the playwright, as well as the good and the evil slave master. Patrick, whose parents are from Nigeria, plays the roles of several slave owners in whiteface, upturning the old performer in blackface trope. That is one of the many tricks or techniques employed in An Octoroon to challenge that old version of the Boucicault play, and indeed to challenge modern audiences. Helen Meaney has been to see An Octoroon, and she's with me in studio this evening. Maybe just to have, so that we have some kind of context for this, Helen, tell me a little bit about the original Boucicault play, The Octoroon. Boucicault, big melodrama, stereotypical characters, caricatures almost, is quite often what he gave us on stage.
Yes, he did. I mean, he was a superstar of the theatre in, you know, both sides of the Atlantic in the 19th century. He really was a remarkable figure, a playwright, actor, producer. And he wrote this this play set in a Louisiana slave, a cotton plantation, obviously worked by slaves, just before the American Civil War. And it is a play about a love story, among other things. It is a love story between the white visiting nephew of the plantation owner who has died, who falls in love with this young woman called Zoe, who is the octoroon of the title. Now, you might not know what that means. That is, it's a really, I suppose, troubling term to us, which is that an eighth of this character's blood is black. Yeah. And this is from the original Boucicault.
Yeah, so, well, if we can get the oct bit there, yeah, I don't want to think absolutely about the second part of the word.
It's a story about the plantation that going into a financial crisis. Mm. And, you know, one way of saving it is for the young man George to marry another plantation, the daughter of another plantation owner, or to follow his heart and to marry Zoe, yeah, who confesses to him that she is one-eighth black in a really upsetting sort of scene. Yeah. So it's full of Boucicault's characteristic melodramatic characters. There's the damsel in distress, there's the hero, there's the dastardly villain, and all sorts of chases, yeah, and murders and mayhem.
In general, in the Boucicault canon, how problematic a play is it considered to be? I mean, The Octoroon, would it even see the light of day as a production, or does it need this type of rethinking for us to look at it with our knowledge in 2022?
It's full of racial stereotypes. So the slaves are caricatured. Everybody is caricatured. So it wouldn't work for us. Yeah. I mean, of course, Boucicault created these sort of exaggerated types, if you like, almost like a commedia dell'arte. And there are, of course, Irishmen in his plays, and that's referred to in this. But the reason it needs this framing, if you like, or a rewriting or a writing back from a black playwright.
Right, and from that perspective. So this is the playwright in question here is Brandon Jacobs Jenkins. So how has he framed it, or what has he done to the play to either make us aware of the problems with the original play or to address them face on?
It's both a sort of a recreation and adaptation of it, and also a commentary on it. So he frames it. He introduces a character playing the playwright himself in a prologue where Patrick Martins playing the playwright, is commenting on the difficulty of being a black playwright and creating black characters who are not victims or criminals, or who are not stereotyped by our current stereotypes of people being sort of on the margins or in trouble. So he's directly addressing the audience and meditating on all of this. So as a prologue.
Yeah, and that Patrick Martins, that character played by Patrick Martins, essentially the playwright himself, that is a 21st century playwright saying, how do I tackle this play?
Exactly. So this is a prologue, and into this then a character of Boucicault himself,
played by
another playwright,
Rory Nolan,
and played by Rory Nolan.
Hang on a little minute. This is my play.
This play. So they have this dialogue. So it's all about how do you write a play for the 21st century about race, and how do we deal with Boucicault's legacy? So this is already becoming quite a meta construct, where they're commenting on the play that we're about to see. They're commenting on Boucicault's play, and also all of his career, and the fact that Boucicault is complaining that he's no longer in fashion. Yeah. So we're already setting up a sort of series of layers.
Right, so there's a real discussion going on between a 21st century playwright and a 19th century playwright. One of the other things the 21st century playwright might want to say to him, have you any idea about the, maybe not the attention span, but what modern audiences want? They don't want a five-act play with 35 subplots that plod along and that we can get totally and absolutely lost. If we began to explain them, we'd get lost. Yes. How is that addressed here? Because is An Octoroon, the new version, does it kind of deal with the wandering plots that a Boucicault play might have?
Yeah, I mean, it gives us a good chunk of the Boucicault plot, it has to be said, which is very elaborate, as always, and extremely contrived and you know, pretty silly.
Yeah.
And we get a lot of that. So we move from this prologue into the Louisiana cotton plantation, and then we go into a scene where two slaves talk about the reality of being a slave, but they're using very much 21st century slang, and then we go into the Boucicault plot itself.
And is that very clear to us? Are we clear when essentially we have 21st century characters commenting on what they're about to do? I mean, is it a sense that they're almost performing the play for us? Is it very clear when we shift from a modern perspective to the 19th century play?
It is, actually, because Boucicault is so distinctive, and it follows the plot of the romance and what was called, you know, a mortgage problem, a mortgage problem play, which is all about the financial rescue of the estate. And then we go into a slave auction, which takes place to try and save the plantation owner's finances, which is extremely difficult to watch, you know. So we move from that opening scene with the two slaves who are in 21st century lingo. We then go into Boucicault's own text. I'm making it possibly sound more complicated than it is.
It is
complicated. Yeah. There are layers upon layers.
Yeah, but when we're looking at that Boucicault section of, for example, the slave auction. What do you think is, are we being presented it in such a way that we're appalled or that we're questioning what's going on?
Yes, very much.
How is that given to us?
Well, because everybody is in, most of the actors are in whiteface if they're black, or there's also a Native American character played by Rory Nolan also. So everybody is wearing...
That's so-called redface?
Yes, that's called redface. Yeah. So all these things are exaggerated, almost like painted on, literally, to remind us of the horrendous situation of people being sold, as human beings being sold. So we're constantly being reminded of the representation of race in theatre and in film. And that's really what the subject of this whole play is. It's about trying to draw our attention to the use of caricature and stereotype.
What about the type of, I mean, you've mentioned the slave auction, but there's language in this that is, to say the very least, obscene. The N-word is used.
Yeah, lots of use of the
N-word. And not necessarily always by people of colour. It may be used by white people in a totally derogatory fashion.
Yeah, I mean, these things are...
How shocking is that to actually sit in the theatre, and what was the reaction in the audience to it?
Well, I saw that quite a few people walked out, actually, during it's about 2 hours and 40 minutes, and people walked out at different stages, and obviously without following them and interviewing them, you wouldn't really know why, were they shocked, were they offended, or were they just not enjoying it? You know, it's hard to know, but certainly people came back after the interval and then left during the slave auction scene. So maybe they just found that too distressing. Actually, the worst scene, I mean, in the worst in sense of drawing attention to, you know, not that long ago how people thought about race, is when Zoe confesses, inverted commas, to her lover that she is, in fact, one eighth part of her blood is black, and she talks about being tainted and having the curse of the mark of Cain, and I mean, that's from the original.
Yeah, and I'm guessing that when that was in the Busico play, that was considered absolutely hilarious, potentially.
Well, I think she was meant to be more of a tragic. She was the damsel in distress. So we were meant to feel very sorry that she unfortunately was black. I mean, so that's the
Busico take on it.
Yeah, I mean, and actually there were riots during the run in New York, and then Busico changed changed the ending for London because the laws about interracial marriage had changed and so on. So the more you know about the performance history, the more
you get from this.
Yeah.
However, whatever can be said or not said about Busico and his stereotypes and his caricatures and his high melodrama and all the rest, he's very entertaining generally, and you should get a few good laughs. You might even feel sentimental lumps in your throat at certain parts of it. He knows how to manipulate the emotions. Do we get that in An Octoroon? Do we get that same type of melodramatic manipulation of the audience?
You get the humour at the beginning, and then it becomes more and more serious. And I think the fact that the characters are basically wearing heightened makeup to change their racial identity makes it more serious. Mm. And also, it has to be said that it's difficult to stage Busico with the right lightness of touch, and it can become laboured. And I think there is actually a little bit too much of the creaking plot of Busico
I could have done with less Busico.
And in some ways, I don't see why, because if you're going to adapt it, you could have actually pruned it a bit. I mean, there are some lovely. I mean, Rory Nolan, of course, is brilliant at playing Busico because he has that. He has that just comic timing, and there's a dance, I believe, to
Cardi B.
There's a really funny dance at the beginning, but the humor, I think, evaporates as we go on, and in fact, it becomes less about that and more about telling us and reminding us.
Yeah, but perhaps that is the point of the play. Then it is to say, you know, I know you want to laugh here, but perhaps you need to think about check what you're laughing at.
And you're constantly being asked to check your own prejudices and expectations.
And how does it work at that level then, as a thought provoking piece?
It works better as a thought-provoking piece. Actually, I found myself thinking a lot about it afterwards, trying to find out more about the playwright and about his other work, than it does as an enjoyable. I found it a little long. I found the direction a little heavy-handed at times. And also, there's a white rabbit character, shall we say, who just is a little bit too cutesy for my taste. But it's a real milestone in Irish theatre.
Yeah,
and it's important in that regard.
A lot of excitement around Patrick Martins, who plays.
He's excellent, and he plays three roles, several characters.
Yeah,
yeah, and he at one point he's wearing a brilliant costume that is white on one side, black on the other, and he's playing both his characters, and they're fighting each
Having
other
conversations
physically,
with himself.
Physically fighting.
Wow!
So great movement direction, great costumes by Molly O'Cohan. So you know, there are lovely touches in the physical stage.
And other performances, I know you've mentioned Rory Nolan. Beyond that, are there other performances that stood out for you, or moments perhaps that really were strong?
Lovely ensemble. I mean, the character of Dora, who the would-be fiancée.
Yeah, played by Maeve O'Mahony.
Yes, she's wearing this massive, one of the biggest crinoline dresses I've ever seen. And it's almost as if she's being sort of moved along by her dress, carried rather than the other way around. And she's playing the quintessential Southern belle, and she has some great moments, you know, of comedy. But as I said, it does become more and more serious, and they stop the action at one point, and Busico and the playwright character return and have a big discussion about the purpose of the fourth act in a melodrama. And basically they don't perform the fourth act, they just sort of narrate it.
Right.
So it becomes very much a commentary on performance, which is a, you know, real interest to theatre studies students and to people like me. But it's a really interesting kind of mixture of a kind of a lesson in sort of dramaturgy
Right. Is it worth going to see? Are you recommending this?
I am. I mean, having said, you know, with those caveats, I think it's really important that the Abbey is staging this and that we have a black director, a black playwright, a predominantly black cast. And I just hope that there'll be more to come and that our theatre will become more and more inclusive, that this won't just be a sort of a token gesture.
Yeah, we should mention the director too, Anthony Simpson Pike, as you say, in there, and Patrick Martins as those several characters.
Yes, yeah.
That's An Octoroon, Helen Meaney speaking to us about that. It runs at the Abbey Theatre through until May the 4th. abbeytheatre.ie for full details. In 2012, aspiring writer Hannah Horvath arrived on our TV screens, announcing that if she wasn't going to be the voice of her generation, she at least wanted to be a voice of a generation. The HBO series Girls recently turned 10, the brainchild of creator, writer and star Lena Dunham. In many ways, the series picked up where Sex and the City left off, but with a far more earthy feel. Set in Brooklyn, the women of this show were in financially precarious situations, but crucially, they were still white, still highly educated and still highly connected. The series was replete with controversial talking points, nudity, bad sex, messy female friendships and complex gender politics. But also, it was criticised on many fronts, not least its entirely white central cast and its failure to successfully engage with race. Despite that, the show was key in opening up the small screen to shows written and performed by young women, people like Issa Rae, Phoebe Waller-Bridge and Michaela Quell. And joining me now to take a look at the legacy of Lena Dunham's Girls, is Dr. Jory Lagerway, Associate Professor in Television Studies in UCD, co-author of the book Horrible White People, Gender, Genre and Television's Precarious Whiteness. And just to, for those who maybe are not that familiar with Girls, would you set up what the actual premise was here for us, Jory?
Yeah, so we have four 20-something young women living in New York post-college, and they are failing. Usually when we see those kinds of girls, they are in amazing relationships, getting their first job, finding success, exploring the world. And here we see them losing jobs in terrible relationships or breaking up, losing jobs, finding really dissatisfying jobs, working unpaid internships, you know, not being able to afford their rent, really struggling instead of the kind of usual happy sitcom-y women that we're accustomed to.
So I suppose more in some ways real or ordinary type of situations we were presenting with. Was that essentially what set it apart, or were there other things that were vital to it? Or is that, that setup that you're giving us, was that its big difference in 2012?
Yeah, I think it was key to that moment in 2012. And that is absolutely what made it exciting. There were lots of women with problems shows on at the time, but they tended to be middle-aged women. So they were dealing with marital problems and kid problems and job problems. And so we've got a younger demographic dealing actually with the same problems, but targeting a younger audience and, you know, with maybe more exciting parties to go to and things like that.
Financial problems, financial precariousness, or being in a difficult situation, that seemed to be important right across the series as well. Mm-hmm. How precarious were the actual finances of these characters, and how important was that aspect?
That was a really central feature of the show, and it absolutely was speaking to the post 2008 recession and this generation of kids who were in high school and college thinking they were going to go out. And it was the era of follow your passion, follow your dreams, right? You don't have to make money if you love what you do. It doesn't matter. And then the crash came and it turned out you actually really do need money. And so they were facing this world where they weren't getting paid and they couldn't follow their dreams. And mostly their parents were paying their way.
And here's a scene where the central character of Hannah is approaching her parents with actually saying, yeah, any chance of a few bob? And the parents are putting her right.
We're not going to be supporting you any longer.
See, I wasn't going to phrase it like that, Lorraine, the way you phrased it.
But I have no job.
No, you have an internship that you say is going to turn into a job.
I don't know when.
You graduated from college 2 years ago. We've been supporting you for 2 years, and that's enough.
Do you know how crazy the economy is right now? I mean, all my friends get help from their parents.
We are sympathetic to that.
But I'm your only child. It's not like I'm draining all your resources. I mean, this feels very arbitrary.
You don't know anything about our finances. I mean, we're professors, Hannah, professors. No, we can't keep bankrolling your groovy lifestyle.
My groovy lifestyle?
The bills add up. We're covering your rent, your insurance, your cell phone.
You said it was cheaper for you if I was on the family plan.
Yeah.
May I get you more of anything?
No, she's fine.
It's good to have your parents telling you that you're fine. That's Peter Buscolari and Becky Ann Baker as the parents of Hannah, as played by Lena Dunham in the series Girls. And Jodie Lagerway is with me this evening discussing, I suppose, what it was about this series in 2012. As I said at the beginning before the programme tonight, Jodie, that so many people, it spoke to them so clearly, and so many other people got so annoyed and angry about. So I suppose we have to talk about Lena Dunham. First of all, How did she manage to get HBO to take on this series?
It was a really calculated marketing move on the part of HBO, actually. So she had kind of indie cred with this film Tiny Furniture that had won an award at South by Southwest. And that's all she had done. But HBO was trying to launch its first digital platform, so it needed to reach out to a new, younger audience. And it was trying to break its reputation of this place where only really dark, broody men succeed on Sopranos and The Wire and shows like that. And its biggest competitor, Showtime, had loads of female-centered content with shows like Weeds and Nurse Jackie and things like that, those kind of women's with problems shows. And so they needed a young woman. They needed her to be a little bit alternative. And they actually needed her to have that indie cred and maybe even those artist parents to fit in with their brand of, you know, prestige authors who were making these great artful shows.
A little bit of manipulation going on here is what you're suggesting. But the thing that maybe Lena Dunham brought in her writing, particularly to this, not only this financial precariousness, which is an important topic, the topic of sex and how sex was being experienced by young women at the time. What did she do there?
She gave us this really, at the time, different view of sex. And it was not quite to Me Too and the blow up around that yet, but it was definitely in the air. And she gave us a normal woman's body in its grossness and its really unsatisfying sex, and sex that is sometimes played for comedy but often just really sad.
And I suppose the context we have to have here is coming off the back of Sex and the City, which had presented a very different type of sex, let's face it. And there are constant comparisons there. How does that muzzy up what we think about Girls when we start that comparison with Sex and the City?
No, I think actually Girls, and I don't want to speak for Lena Dunham, but I don't think she would dispute the fact that her show is actually speaking directly to Girls. To Sex and the City. It wouldn't exist without Sex and the City. Partly because HBO needed the new Sex and the City when they were looking for Girls. But also, Shoshana, one of the main characters, has a giant Sex and the City poster on her wall throughout the whole series.
You just explain, though, there are four kind of main girls, and I'm using inverted commas there, Shoshana and Hannah. Shoshana being one of them, who you've just mentioned.
Yeah.
Were they four types, essentially? Or was there more to them than that?
I mean, they were similar to Sex and the City. You know, in Sex and the City, when you were watching, you could be like, oh, I'm a Charlotte, I'm a Carrie. And I think all of the girls were so awful that you never wanted to necessarily claim that identity, but still they were giving us sort of four distinct character types. Hannah was maybe a little bit messier than some of the others, but Shoshana was, you know, really uptight.
Yeah.
Jessa was the hippie, and Marnie was this, you know, very proper girl who was kind of slumming it.
Now, ironically, I was thinking tonight that we're coming off the back of our review of An Octoroon at the Abbey, which deals with the whole issue of racial representation in theatre as far back as the 19th century. Mm-hmm. Race was one of the things that, and the representation of race in this, or perhaps the lack of representation of race in this programme, was one of the major criticisms.
Yeah, it really came in rightfully for a lot of flack for being an entirely white New York. Mm. And lots of shows have set in New York have faced that same criticism. But the real problem is that in an era of Black Lives Matter, when it is absolutely impossible in New York, in America, to be unaware of racial conflict, this was a show that was absolutely, utterly unself-aware about the fact that it was entirely white. And so it did rightfully come in for some criticism, right? Do you have the clip from Donald Glover?
Is that what you're about to? Yeah, I have that. I have that very clip. So let's have a listen to that. This was in series two, in fact, where there was an attempt to engage with race. Mm-hmm. And Hannah, the Lena Dunham character, again, is here with her black boyfriend, a character called Sandy, who's a Republican, and he's played by Donald Glover. As she often was, she's trying to dump him. Or she's decided she might be dumping him at this point.
I also would love to know how you feel about the fact that 2 out of 3 people on death row are black men.
Wow, Hannah. I didn't know that. Thank you for enlightening me about how things are tougher for minorities. Thank you.
I can't tell if you're being sarcastic.
I am.
Okay, well, it's hard for me to say because I really like you, but I think our political beliefs are just too different and that we should just be friends.
I knew this. This always happens. This always happens.
What
I don't
always
even know.
Happens?
This whole, like, oh, I'm a white girl and I moved to New York and I'm having a great time. And, oh, I got a fixed gear bike and I'm going to date a black guy. And we're going to go to a dangerous part of town. All that bullshit. Like, yeah, I know this. I've seen it happen a million times. And then they can't deal with who I am.
You know what? Honestly, maybe you should think about the fact that you could be fetishizing me, because how many white women have you dated? Sounds like a lot from what you just said.
What?
And really? Maybe you think of us as just one big white blobby mass with, like, stupid ideas that you can't deal with. So why don't you lay this thing down, flip it, and reverse it? Because I don't think it's very nice.
You just said a Missy Elliott lyric. And
I don't
sure
know who that is.
No, bullshit, okay? It doesn't
mean the joke's on you, because you want to know what? I never thought about the fact that you were black once.
That's insane, okay?
That's Donald Glover and Lena Dunham there in a scene from Girls from Seasons 2 of Girls. We're talking about that. The series came into our TV screens 10 years ago, and Jory Lagerway with me in studio. See, there's so much irony in that. It's quite difficult to know how was that received, and how did it get past its racial difficulties, if you like, the series Girls?
Yeah, so that storyline with Donald Glover was really poorly received because it very much felt like a Band-Aid after season one, facing so much criticism. They threw in this black character and, look, we're being unexpected. He's a Republican. But they make Donald Glover say all of the things about race, right? She even says, I never thought of you as black. And he points out that that's utterly ridiculous. Mm. And so what the show does throughout is what lots of white people do, is never think about race, right? Because we kind of don't have to. And so it never really recovered. Right, it never did it well, ever.
Why did Lena Dunham herself annoy so many people, do you think?
I think for a couple of reasons. One, that she was vocally liberal in public. And women on social media, it's just true, will face harsher criticisms than other people. But I also think that she bled into her character a bit too much, and her character was so deeply insufferable and so self-involved that people projected that onto Lena, whether that
was
her or not.
Well.
Exactly, yeah.
What is the legacy then of Girls? What did it actually open up things for other programs and other debates that perhaps it deserves credit for?
Yeah, for sure. I think it has a couple of legacies, and you mentioned at the top that, you know, my writing partner and I wrote this book called Horrible White People, and Girls is where we start that book. And we give girls the credit, if you want to call it that, for starting this cluster of sitcoms, or this new version of a sitcom that's actually really, really dark. It's got a bunch of really sad, failing white people in broken relationships, losing their jobs, doing lots of drugs, having a lot of sex, some of which is good, some of which is bad. And Girls, I think, gets all the credit for kicking off that cycle, for being really successful and then proliferating. And then the other thing I think that is maybe... it's not as straightforward, but white women tend to have success before women of color. And so when Lena Dunham gets success, it does make it just that tiny bit easier for Issa Rae and Michaela Cole and other folks to get into to that along. Space next. So, as well as other white women creators, like you mentioned Phoebe Waller-Bridge and Fleabag. And I think there's a bit of credit for Lena for those things.
Well, that's Jory Lagerwey speaking to us about Girls. And if you want to watch the entire six seasons, or even one, to get a taste of it, you can do so on Now TV. So to our album reviews on this Friday evening, we'll be starting with English rock band Bloc Party, formed in 2003. Debut album 2 years later, it was entitled Silent Army. It went on to give us Sound Alarm, I beg your pardon. They went on to give us five more albums. Number six arrives today. It's entitled Alpha Games. Second will be Irish singer-songwriter Sive, released her crowd-funded debut album, The Roaring Girl, in 2017. Her sixth album, We Begin in Darkness, arrives today. And finally, English duo Let's Eat Grandma. They give us their third album it is, in fact, Two Ribbons. Zara Hederman and Paul McClune have been listening, and we're going to start with Bloc Party. Alpha Games is the title of the new album, and this is a song called Traps. Traps from Bloc Party and their new album Alpha Games. And as I said, Paul McClune and Zara Hederman are two reviewers on this Friday evening. We're talking about Arctic Monkeys, Kaiser Chiefs, and that sort of era here, Zara. Do they set themselves apart? Did they set themselves apart back in the day?
They certainly did. When they exploded on the scene back in 2005 with Silent Alarm, they really distinguished themselves from the likes of Arctic Monkeys, Kaiser Chiefs and Klaxons, who now would be kind of pigeonholed in this landfill indie kind of genre, as it's now retrospectively called. Whereas Bloc Party were always slightly more distinguished. They were a bit more angular in their instrumentation. Kelly O'Korek as a frontman was also just a bit more interesting and singing about kind of more interesting things as well. But it's interesting that this album has come about because they did a recent anniversary tour for Silent Alarm, and they really enjoyed going back to that 2005 sound.
And that's what I wondered, given that and coming off the back of that tour, Paul, to what extent are we getting Bloc Party saying, do you know what? This is what we did, and this is perhaps what we should still be doing, and this is what we should do best and did best.
Yes, I certainly detected a degree of that, certainly about the first half of this record, the kind of return. I actually, back in the day, was a bit Bloc Party sceptical, I've got to be honest. I kind of found their there was something a little self-conscious about their recycling of the kind of Wire and Gang of Four kind of post-punk sort of vibes. I don't know why particularly then, because a lot of bands were doing it at that time. And in fact, they came up partly under the patronage of Franz Ferdinand, if memory serves. I think they were instrumental in getting them on the radar, so to speak. But I actually preferred their kind of stuff as they progressed. They went into newer, more experimental, electronic kind of areas on a couple of records. And I actually found that stuff a bit more interesting than the earlier stuff. But maybe the core kind of fan base want a return to that sort of bluster and that kind of angularity. But I don't think they even pull that off quite as interestingly here as they did before.
I'm kind of torn between going to a track that I think really worked and a track that I think didn't work at all. Let's talk about the track that didn't work at all and see where we're going. Well, I think...
Which one?
Yeah. the title says it all. The girls are fighting.
Yeah, I wasn't particularly fond of that one. And
tell us what's so bad about this. I mean, as I said, the title kind of, you could be throwing your eyes up to heaven all night on that one.
What's frustrating about this song and the album as a whole is that Kelly Okereke is generally, I think, quite a good lyricist. And we saw that on his solo album from last year. And this one is just... he's writing in characters, and for me, reading through the lyrics of this album, they're just very inconsequential. And here we have the girls are fighting and the boys can't cope. So this is a story about like a nightclub and a night kind of towards the end where everything's getting a bit leery and messy. And it's just, you know, if you're a longstanding fan of Bloc Party, you're not really kind of on the same wavelength with them.
Okay, well, so... we didn't like that track. No. So let's try another one and see if we can get an agreement on it. Just wants to get to you should know the truth, you should know the truth. Now, it's a repeated lyric that, a bit like the Marmite thing, you'll either love it or after the 14th chorus and 2900th repeat of it, you'll go, oh, stop, please.
Yeah, I mean, I actually do agree with Zara, though it hadn't actually occurred to me until she said it, but you're absolutely right. Lyrically, there's a less going on with this record. I think
you did kind of jump to the defence of the girls are fighting a bit earlier on.
Well, I do, but I'm just showing me age, I like a glam stomper. So right. If you like that kind of...
And did you like You Should Know the Truth?
I did, and partly because when it arrives on the album, I'm kind of, the first couple of tracks have kind of got me a bit irked, to be honest, because there's just not much in the way of a hook going on. So when that comes along, okay, it's repetitive, but at least it's kind of melodic and it's kind of moving more towards, I think a kind of a tune, really, I was kind of crying out for. There's all these really impressive shards of metallic guitar and kind of angularity, and it's all very bitty. And some of it feels a little calculatedly so, where they're kind of almost... going back to, as we touched on already, kind of go, what is it we used to do? Oh, let's do more of that. Whereas other parts of the record where they get away from that template are actually much more interesting.
Okay, so it kind of half works, I think, is what you're saying. Stars, yeah. Paul?
What did I give it now when I was in a good mood? Oh, yeah, 3. No, that's fair enough. 3 out of 5.
Yeah. And Zara?
I gave it 2.5 because I feel like they're going too far backwards and stumbling instead of going forwards.
All right, fair enough.
Fans will be happy though.
Okay, all right. Let us move on then to Sive and We Begin in Darkness. Before we hear a track from her, set up for us, Cesar, if you would, who Sive is and what she's achieved.
Yeah, so she is a Kildare-based singer-songwriter and has really become quite a prominent figure in the alt-folk realm in particular. She's toured with the likes of Mick Flannery, Keela, Christy Moore, Gemma Hayes. And what's really impressive, I think, with this album, her second one, is just... the artistic statement she makes with it, she's very assured and she's doing something I think really rich and lush with it. So it's very accomplished.
All right, here's a track called Think Before I Speak.
I think before I speak sometimes. That I don't
Think Before I Speak, a track from Sive and her new album, which is called We Begin in Darkness. We were saying as we were listening to that, Paul, a lot of stuff going on there. You hear this lovely plucking rhythm. I'm not sure if it's a harp. I think you might be able to enlighten us. I think you mentioned, Zara, it's a type of Portuguese guitar. We'll come back on that.
Oh,
but there's all sorts of rhythmic stuff going on under, you know, a very beautiful melody and beautiful vocal performance.
Yeah, and that drummer, I've no idea who the drummer is, but whoever it is, he or she is great on this record, because it kind of, it's very busy, and it's kind of, we were saying it's a bit kind of prog rock, and there's a wee bit, you almost like a Radiohead kind of thing there, listening back to that for the third or fourth time now. Mm. But it doesn't get in the way of the song, which I think sometimes is a hard thing to pull off. If somebody wants to be quite busy and quite showy in terms of, because technically that's very good drumming.
Yeah.
But there isn't always a place for that, particularly in kind of what you might call folk music or alt folk music. Somehow it works, and I think it sort of speaks to a real deftness and maturity in terms of the artist and the production, and all these funny little things, strange little changes in time signature, lots of technical little things going on that you notice more and more the more you listen, but it never gets in the way of putting the song across.
And that is extraordinary, because I mean, some of the lyrics are quite complex, and the stories that she's telling are quite complex, yet you've all this complexity in the music as well. You do know about the Portuguese guitar, I think.
I just know the name of it. It's a cavaquinho. Which when I was listening to initially, it reminded me like a lot of a harpsichord. I really liked that kind of the lightness and the brightness in it, because it does work so well to bring a bit more dexterity to the overall timbre of the album, which generally is brilliant. And she's also gotten Aina Brennan on this to do string accompaniments, and they just as well add another great texture to it. And as we heard there, Sive's voice is just stupendous to listen to.
Yeah, let's have a listen to another song a little bit further down the track list. This is called Dancing Alone. Again, that beautiful mix of complicated rhythms and jumping rhythms in there, Paul, as well as the vocal quality.
It's a great, great mix. And she doesn't do it the whole way through the record. We were just talking about a couple other parts of the record where this sort of absents itself. But when it is happening, it's really impressive. And I got to say, I think Sive is... She was a bit of an unknown quantity to me now, I won't lie, but I'm hugely impressed by this record. I think it's just tremendous, and her voice is incredible. And I like everything about the record. I like her voice, I like the songwriting, I like the arrangements, I like the production. I just think it's a great listen.
And while to a large extent we're talking about alt funk almost, or alt folk, I beg your pardon, or even alt trad, I thought it is at times as well, if such a genre exists, there are times when it's more straightforward, but I'm not so sure that they please you, Zara.
Not necessarily, because I think this album starts so strongly and I really enjoy going back to it. But as the album progressed, there was just a few songs towards the end, like Bera and I Don't Know, which the two of them just felt, compared to the rest of the album, just a little underdeveloped and didn't really stand up to what we were getting earlier on in the album.
Right. And so what does that mean in terms of stars from you, Zara, first of all?
I think this shows great promise and I'm looking forward for more. So it's 3.5 for me.
3.5. Paul?
I'll take that half and add it to mine, because I really liked Bera. I thought it was a beautiful folk song.
Which is a more straightforward.
It's more straightforward. String arrangement is gorgeous. Kind of reminded me of Sandy Denny, who I'm a sucker for anyway. So, you know, for that score alone, I will give it a 4.
So 4 from you. Yeah. Let us move on then to Let's Eat Grandma and their new album, which is called Two Ribbons. We'll start straight away with a song. I think this is the opening track, is it? Happy New Year, I think it is.
Sparks in the sky until we meet the sunrise, then see the year come into bloom. And nothing that was broken can touch so much I care for you. Because you know you'll always be my best friend. And look at what I have with you. I said I don't know how.
There we go, a little taste of, yes, it is the opening track, Happy New Year, from Let's Eat Grandma and their album Two Ribbons. There's a kind of a backstory here. Maybe give us the lyrics of that song, because it kind of tells us the problem that was going on. But these girls who went to school together as junior infants, they weren't junior infants when they were in England, whatever, year one, and they've been pals all their lives.
They have. They've been friends since they were 4. And in that song, we hear a line, "And nothing that was broken can touch how much I care for you, because you'll always know you'll be my best friend. And look what we've made." And that is a huge recurring theme across this album, which is their 3rd. And they began making music. They released their first album when they were 16. They're now 22. And one of the themes here is how they're kind of naturally growing up and growing apart and wanting to be a bit more independent.
Yeah.
And the Two Ribbons, even of the album title, there's the song later on. It talks about kind of the analogy of them now being two separate kind of entities, but they're still woven together, but they are fraying.
Yeah, I must say, I
was the metaphor.
Today I was listening to these songs and thinking, you can still be friends, please. But yeah, it is that thing, if somebody who's your friend all through your school years, and you kind of just drift apart. It's not that you fall out with each other, you just grow in different ways.
Of course, it's a tremendously formative period of anybody's life, but also they were in the spotlight. They were very, you know, at an indie level, a lot of kind of attention on them and a lot of hype and a lot of kind of, you know, kerfuffle around the duo, this very young duo when they first came along. So I guess that's something to deal with as well, and it's an added kind of pressure on any relationship, particularly a friendship, particularly at that time of life. So it's an interesting reflection on that. And as the record starts, it's kind of a bouncy Robin kind of summery dance thing there, but already you're detecting a kind of a melancholy undertow to the thing that sort of develops as the record goes on.
Yeah, I mean, we were all saying as we were listening to that we really liked the second half of the album better.
Yes.
So let's have a listen to a little bit of a track called Strange Conversations, which is right down, the second last track on the album, in fact.
I'd like to speak with you, if that's alright. Thought I might find you here, where wasted youth lay near, through all that's insincere into the quiet, with doves surrounding you. This mottled sky turns blue. And I'm at the altar.
Just just wanted to get a little taste of that, Sarah. You know, the acoustic feel that kind of creeps in as the album progresses. And there is another side, apart from the breakup, not the breakup, but the difficulties in the friendship. There was a loss of a boyfriend in here at a very young age.
Very young age. So one of the duo, Jenny Hollingworth, her partner, who was also an aspiring songwriter himself, he passed away at the age of 22 in 2019, just before they were going on tour in the US for their second album. So he died of a rare bone cancer, and that also is interwoven into this album, into that song in particular. And there's another song, it's an instrumental called In the Cemetery.
Yeah.
And the way that Hollingworth writes about that loss is very profound and very nuanced as well.
Does it work overall and stars, Paul?
I like it more towards the end of it. It gets sadder, but it gets better. And I'll give it 3.5, 3.5 out of 5.
Yeah, I don't know, maybe I needed a little bit of melancholy and sadness. But that second half of the album, I must say this morning, I've really found it very moving. How did it work overall for you, Zara, and stars?
The two different tones kind of jarred a bit for me, and I wish maybe it was two separate EPs or something like that. But I would give this a 3.5.
Right, fairly solid 3.5 from you. That's for Two Ribbons from Let's Eat Grandma. We didn't even get to the name, which I know drove you nuts, Paul.
It's grown on me.
Yeah. And we also spoke about We Begin in Darkness from Sive and Alpha Games from Block Party. And that is our lot for this Friday evening. Liam Murphy, Paula Shields researched. Michelle Gibson was the broadcast coordinator. Jamie Doyle was in sound. Tonight's programme produced by Sinead Egan. Talk to you on Monday. We have a special programme looking back at some of the great interviews that we had, including Jarvis Cocker's in there, Kelly MacDonald is in there, and others. That'll be on Monday evening, and I'll be back with you as usual on Tuesday. But John Creedon will be with you after the 8 o'clock news.